During this hour, I'd like to talk about the economic thought of the Roman State Church. These are obviously related papers. In fact, I've included the bibliography for the two papers in only one of them, so they're to be read as a unit. And if anybody doesn't have a copy of the economic thought, there's more copies up here on the panel if you would like to get one. I think we've distributed many of them. Historians know of only a few scattered and ad hoc statements on economic matters during the first millennium after Christ. The official philosopher of the Roman State Church, Thomas Aquinas, wrote no treatise on economics in the 13th century, but his thinking, based on that of Aristotle, is foundational for understanding the economic thought of the Roman State Church. Essays and treatises on economics did not appear until the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, when, following the Reformation and the emergence of capitalism, economies developed to the point that it occurred to some observers that there was something to write about. When market order appeared on a large scale after the Reformation, some astute observers noticed that market order, an order not achieved by human design, was a phenomenon that required an explanation. So was born the discipline of economics. Most of these writers, however, were not Romanist, and they wrote outside the control of the Roman State Church. It was not Roman Catholic countries whose economies developed rapidly, but the economies of Protestant countries. Almost all the early economists tended to be Protestant or at least non-Romanist. Like her political thought, the economic thought of the Roman State Church has been remarkably consistent for centuries, adhering to the primitive and erroneous insights of Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas. Her fundamental principles have remained the same even while their development and application have differed over the centuries. Roman State Church economic thought, as developed by the popes in their encyclicals and by the Roman State Church councils, has been a contributor to, if not the only source of, several forms of anti-capitalist economic organization during the long hegemony of the Roman State Church. Among these forms are feudalism and guild socialism in the Middle Ages, fascism in Italy, Spain, Portugal, Croatia, and Latin America in the 20th century, Nazism in Germany in the 20th century, interventionism and the redistributive state in the West, including the United States in the 20th century, and liberation theology in Latin America and Africa in the 20th century. Understand how the economic thought of the Roman State Church spawned these varieties of statism and collectivism, we must begin with Thomas Aquinas' discussion of private property. Private property is the central economic institution of civilized societies, and it is the Romanist rejection of private property that has led to the establishment of several varieties of collectivism throughout the world. To understand Thomas's doctrine of private property, we must first understand his view of law. According to Thomas, there are four kinds of law. First, there is eternal law, which is God's plan for the universe and all its inhabitants. Thus, it is part of the eternal law that rocks, for example, fall to the ground when dropped, and plants, for example, grow toward the light. Second, there is the natural law, which is the participation of rational creatures in the eternal law. Thus, man is by nature a social animal. When men speak to each other and live in societies, they are doing what is natural to them, just as rocks and plants do. Third, there is the positive law, which is customs, laws, and regulations made by governors attempting to apply the natural law to individuals and societies. Finally, there is the divine law, such as the Ten Commandments. Property, according to Thomas, is neither part of the natural law nor an absolute right, but an invention of human reason. It is a creation of and regulated by positive law. Rather than private property being part of the natural law, the possession of all things in common is the natural law. Thomas wrote, and I quote, "The possession of all things in common and universal freedom are said to be of the natural law because, to wit, the distinction of possessions and slavery were not brought in by nature, but devised by human reason for the benefit of human life." Unquote. The institution of private property, like slavery, is a purely human institution, and therefore rightfully subject to human regulation. The community of goods, wrote Thomas, quote, is ascribed to the natural law, not that the natural law dictates things, that all things should be possessed in common, and that nothing should be possessed as one's own, but because the division of possessions is not according to the natural law, but rather arose from human agreement which belongs to positive law. Hence the ownership of possessions is not contrary to the natural law, but an addition thereto devised by human reason. Unquote. It is important to keep in mind that according to Romanist economic thought, here represented by its greatest philosopher, Thomas Aquinas, that communism with a small c, what Thomas calls the community of goods, is part of the natural law, and that private property is part of the positive law. Private property is an addition to the natural law. Though private property is not contrary to the natural law, it is not itself natural, and it does not enjoy the same metaphysical or ethical status as the community of goods. While men cannot change the natural law, rather they are required to conform to it, according to Roman State Church thought, they can change positive law, and they may do so in whatever manner is expedient and moral. Now, several things might make such a community of goods not only expedient, but morally imperative. One of these things is need. Thomas wrote, things which are of human right cannot derogate from natural right or divine right. The division and appropriation of things which are based on human law do not preclude the fact that man's needs have to be remedied by means of these very things. Hence, whatever certain people have in superabundance is due by natural law to the purpose of succoring the poor. Because the goods of some are due to others by the natural law, there is no sin if the poor take the goods of their neighbors. Thomas wrote, quote, in cases of need, all things are common property, so that there would seem to be no sin in taking another's property, for need has made it common. Unquote. Not only is such taking of property not a sin, it is not even a crime, according to Thomas. Quote, it is lawful for a man to succor his own needs by means of another's property by taking it either openly or secretly. Nor is this, properly speaking, theft and robbery. It is not theft, properly speaking, to take secretly and use another's property in a case of extreme need, because that which he takes for the support of his life becomes his own property by reason of that need. In a case of a like need, a man may also take secretly another's property in order to succor his neighbor in need. Unquote. This philosophy, need is the criterion for the possession of property. Whoever needs it ought to possess it. Need makes another's goods one's own. Need is the ultimate and only moral title to property. Neither possession, nor creation, nor production, nor gift, nor inheritance, nor divine commandment, with the exception of Roman State Church property, grants title to property that is immune to the prior and unquestionable claim of need. Thomas does not inform us what need is or how it might be defined. Apparently, each person is the proper judge of whether he needs his neighbor's goods or not. Indeed, one cannot imagine one person having the ability to judge another person's need. No one can know how hungry another is, nor how much he requires medical care, nor needs information. Each person must be the sole judge of his own need simply because no one else can be. From these doctrines of the natural community of all goods and the primacy of need developed all the varieties of collectivism that the Roman State Church has supported for the past 1,000 years. We find the Romanist doctrine of property echoed in the communist slogan, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. The Romanist doctrine reverberates in the slogan of American liberals, human rights are more important than property rights. It was the creed of Lyndon Johnson's great society, we shall take from the haves and give to the have-nots. It appears in the literature of fascism, Nazism, liberation theology, and socialism. Collectivists agree with Thomas that those who own property are morally and legally obligated to surrender their goods to those in need. Collectivists agree with Thomas that those in need are morally and legally justified in taking the goods of their neighbors. Perhaps if they are inconsistent and cowardly, they might not defend looting or direct action against property owners, but they will and do endorse indirect action through government expropriation, taxation, and regulation. These Thomistic notions, that private property is merely a construct of human reason and government, and that need gives one title to the goods of others, are the reason the Roman State Church bishops in Brazil earlier this year pronounced that looting is neither a sin nor a crime. The needs of the looters give the looters title to the goods they are taking. According to Roman State Church theory, the looters are, by natural law, the rightful owners of those goods. Now let's skip over to page 43. You'll find in the intervening pages a lot of quotations from the popes and the councils on economic thought, but we don't have the time this morning to go into it in great detail, but I have provided the quotes and the citations for anyone who wants to study the issue in detail. This is a postscript to the paper that I'm going to continue with, and it's entitled, "Has the Pope Baptized Ayn Rand and John Calvin?" Because it speaks to the issue of some, the contention of some prominent Roman Catholics of late in the U.S. who say the Pope now endorses capitalism. And again, I'm sorry that the gentleman who asked the question earlier about economics isn't here today. Despite the Roman State Church's strident and sustained attack on economic freedom and capitalism that has now spanned more than a century, a tiny group of American Roman Catholics has begun to argue against all facts that the Roman State Church really favors capitalism. Not only does the State Church favor capitalism now, it has always favored capitalism, we are told. The opposite impression was created by progressive leftists who engaged in a selective reading of the papal encyclicals. Among these revisionist Romanists are Robert Sirico, a Paulist priest who is also president of the Acton Institute in Michigan, and Michael Novak, a fellow of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. Sirico argues, for example, that John Paul II's encyclical, issued in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum in 1991, Centesimus Annus, represents a dramatic development in the encyclical tradition in favor of the free economy. These are quotes from Sirico, not from the Pope. More than any other church document, Sirico writes, this latest one celebrates the creativity of entrepreneurs and the virtues required for productivity. Sirico asserts the Pope affirms both the practical and moral legitimacy of profit, entrepreneurship, appropriate self-interest, productivity, and a stable currency. Furthermore, the 100th year is not only a repudiation of the entire collectivist agenda root and branch, but also the warmest embrace of the free economy since the Scholastics. Sanus evidences the greatest depth of economic understanding and the most deliberate and least critical embrace of the system of free exchange on the part of the Catholic teaching authority in 100 years, and possibly since the Middle Ages. This encyclical constitutes the epitaph for liberation and collectivist movements in terms of any official ecclesiastical legitimacy. All of those quotes are from Sirico. Now, these are certainly important and dramatic claims for this encyclical. One would expect such sweeping claims indicating dramatic developments in Romanist social thought to be supported by many quotations from the encyclical itself. Unfortunately, Sirico quotes the encyclical only twice in his essays. Both quotations are brief. One is irrelevant to the claims he makes, and the other is a brief reference to some of the virtues that compose the Protestant work ethic: diligence, industriousness, prudence, reliability, fidelity, and courage. Any reader of Sirico's essay who actually reads the papal encyclical will be deeply disappointed, for the claims that Sirico makes are simply not supported by the actual statements of the encyclical. Of course, some of the claims may be true. For example, when Sirico writes that Centesimus Annus evidences the greatest depth of economic understanding on the part of Catholic teaching authority in 100 years, he may very well have been correct. After all, our survey of the teaching of the Roman State Church Magisterium turned up no evidence of economic understanding. Instead, we found shrill moral denunciations of the market, of self-interest, and of capitalism, and sustained pleas for government intervention to protect the common good and promote social justice. Sirico compares Centesimus Annus to previous encyclicals so that if the latest papal encyclical is less candid about its criticism of capitalism, it might appear in a somewhat favorable light. And if the Pope praises some of the economic virtues, even though the praise is almost 500 years after Luther and Calvin, then perhaps it is a sign of hope for economically conservative Roman priests like Mr. Sirico. Sirico claims that more than any other church document, this latest one celebrates the creativity of entrepreneurs and the virtue required for productivity, a statement that is unsupported. This writer has not read all church documents, and neither one supposes has Mr. Sirico. In his essay, he discusses only one previous church document, Rerum Novarum, and furnishes us with a creative and inventive misreading of that encyclical as well. But despite his best efforts, Rerum Novarum is so obviously an anti-capitalist document that he is finally embarrassed by it. His desperate attempt to find something of value in the papal encyclical seems to betray him into making statements that he cannot support. Those documents that this writer has read catalog the Roman State Church's long-standing hatred for capitalism on moral grounds, a hatred that has now been expressed by the Magisterium for over a century. P.T. Bauer charitably called these papal encyclicals incompetent, immoral, and envy-exalted. Exactly what did John Paul II say in Centesimus Annus? Since Centesimus Annus was issued in commemoration of Rerum Novarum, he began by praising Rerum Novarum as an immortal document and continued, "The vital energies arising from that root have not been spent with the passing of the years, but rather have increased even more." Continuing his praise for Rerum Novarum for several paragraphs, John Paul II asserted that the validity of this teaching has already been pointed out in two encyclicals published during my pontificate, Laborum Exercens and Solicitudo Rei Socialis. John Paul II proposes a rereading of Rerum Novarum to discover anew the richness of the fundamental principles which it formulated. What are those fundamental principles? John Paul II, echoing Leo XIII, the century before him, began with a Marxist analysis of capitalism. In the sphere of economics, these are quotes from the 100th year, talking about 1891 encyclical Rerum Novarum. In the sphere of economics, new structures for the production of consumer goods had progressively taken shape, speaking of the 19th century. A new form of property had appeared, capital, and a new form of labor, labor for wages, characterized by high rates of production which lacked due regard for sex, age, or family situation, and were determined solely by efficiency, with a view to increasing profits. In this way, labor became a commodity to be freely bought and sold on the market, its price determined by the law of supply and demand, without taking into account the bare minimum required for the support of the individual and his family. Moreover, the worker was not even sure of being able to sell his own commodity, continually threatened as he was by unemployment, which in the absence of any kind of social security meant the specter of death by starvation. Now, you didn't realize social security was such beneficial. The result of this transformation was a society divided into two classes, separated by a deep chasm. Thus, the prevailing political theory of the time sought to promote total economic freedom by appropriate laws, or conversely, by a deliberate lack of any intervention, meaning government intervention. To 5.2. The Pope and the Church were confronted by a society which was torn by a conflict all the more harsh and inhumane because it knew no rule or regulation. It was the conflict between capital and labor. In the face of a conflict which set man against man, almost as if they were wolves, a conflict between the extremes of mere physical survival on the one side and opulence on the other, the Pope did not hesitate to intervene by virtue of his apostolic office. Skipping down to 6.1, with the intention of shedding light on the conflict which had arisen between capital and labor, Pope Leo XIII affirmed the fundamental rights of workers. It may truly be said that it is only by the labor of the working men that states grow rich. Another important principle is undoubtedly that of the right to private property. The Pope is well aware that private property is not an absolute value, nor does he fail to proclaim the necessary complementary principles, such as the universal destination of the earth's goods. Skipping down to 8.1. The Pope immediately adds another right which the worker has as a person. This is the right to a just wage, which cannot be left to the free consent of the parties. This concept of relations between employers and employees, purely pragmatic and inspired by a thoroughgoing individualism, is severely censured in the encyclical. A workingman's wages should be sufficient to enable him to support himself, his wife, and his children. If through necessity or fear of worse, a worse evil, the workman accepts harder conditions because an employer or contractor will afford no better, he is made the victim of force and injustice. Would that these words, written at a time when what has been called unbridled capitalism was pressing forward, should not have to be repeated today with the same severity. This selective rereading of Rerum Novarum by John Paul II, some of the Marxist flavor of the encyclical endorsed it. Leo XIII and John Paul II adopted Marx's view of capitalism, even asserting the labor theory of value. If you look at 6.1, that quote from the encyclical, quoting, this is John Paul II, the infallible present pope, quoting the infallible pope of the end of the 19th century, saying, "It may truly be said that it is only by the labor of the working men that states grow rich." This is Marxism. This is the labor theory of value. It is only the labor of working men by which states grow rich. Both John Paul II and Leo also endorsed the fundamental principle of the universal destination of goods, which holds that need makes all goods, both natural and manufactured, common, and that those who own goods must surrender them to those in need, or their goods will be rightfully taken from them. To say of Rerum Novarum, as Sirico does, that it provides one of the most finely honed defenses of the free market and private property order in the annals of Catholic, indeed Christian, social thought is preposterous and false. Later in Centesimus Annus, John Paul II endorses the slogan of liberation theology, the preferential option for the poor, and wrote more ominously that the Pope does not, of course, intend to condemn every possible form of social conflict. The encyclical Laborum Exercens, moreover, clearly recognized the positive role of conflict when it takes the form of a struggle for social justice. These statements make Sirico's claim that Centesimus Annus constitutes the epitaph for liberation and collectivist movements in terms of any official ecclesiastical legitimacy false. Centesimus Annus is an endorsement of liberation theology. And John Paul II has endorsed liberation theology several times in other documents, as we've already seen. If anything, liberation theology has received greater endorsement from the magisterium in the past 20 years, not less. Section 15 of Centesimus Annus endorses all sorts of government intervention and concludes with this paragraph. Rerum Novarum and the related social teaching of the Church had far-reaching influence in the years bridging the 19th and 20th centuries. This influence is evident in the numerous reforms which are introduced in the areas of Social Security, pensions, health insurance, and compensation in the case of accidents within the framework of greater respect for the rights of workers. What was that far-reaching influence of Rerum Novarum to which John Paul II referred? In Europe, Rerum Novarum granted the moral authority of the Roman state church to the rising tide of statism in all its forms except communism. Socialism, fascism, and Nazism. In the United States, it fueled the rise of the labor union movement, the progressive movement, and interventionism. Aaron I. Abel, in a 1945 essay in the Review of Politics, a source that Sirico himself quotes, sketched the influence of Rerum Novarum in the United States. Cardinal James Gibbon of Baltimore, the leader of the Roman state church hierarchy in the United States in the 19th century, referred to government intervention in the economy as, quote, the most efficacious means, almost the only means, unquote, to thwart business monopoly and, quote, its heartless avarice, which, through greed of gain, piteously grinds not only the men, but even the women and the children in various employments, unquote. As head of the Roman state church hierarchy in the United States, Cardinal Gibbons organized two major Roman Catholic congresses in the United States in 1889 in Baltimore and 1893 in Chicago for the purpose of mobilizing Roman Catholic bishops, priests, and laymen for progressive social action. Speakers at these congresses denounced communism, socialism, and capitalism, and then called for increased government intervention in the economy, especially in the form of graduated taxes on the rich. The congresses voted to establish study groups and to distribute Rerum Novarum far and wide. In the period between the promulgation of Rerum Novarum and the New Deal, the most influential Roman Catholic social thinker in the United States was the priest John Augustus Ryan. His first book, A Living Wage, published in 1906, was a plea for a minimum wage. He wrote dozens of other essays and books advocating the compulsory 8-hour day, restrictions on the labor of women and children, the legalization of picketing during strikes, compulsory arbitration on labor disputes, state employment bureaus, government insurance of unemployment, accidents, sickness, and old age, government housing programs, public ownership of natural monopolies, graduated income taxes, graduated inheritance taxes, prohibition of speculation in the markets, and so forth. Ryan called his program Essential Economic Socialism and Semi-Socialism. In 1908, Ryan became the head of an international Roman Catholic movement for social reform. The first important member organization promoting social reform was the German Roman Catholic Central Verein. In 1917, the hierarchy of the Roman State Church in the United States formed the National Catholic War Council, the predecessor of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. In 1919, the Council's Administrative Committee issued a plan for social reconstruction written by John Ryan. The plan advocated social insurance against unemployment, sickness, invalidity, and old age, a federal child labor law, legal enforcement of labor's right to organize, public housing for the working classes, graduated taxes on inheritances, incomes, and excess profits, stringent regulation of public utility rates, government competition with monopolies, worker participation in business management, and so forth. It is no wonder, then, that when Franklin Roosevelt was elected president in 1932, he asked John Ryan to join his administration, nor is it a wonder that Ryan was nicknamed the Right Reverend New Dealer. 50 years ago, Abel pointed out that, quote, a social view of property served as the entering wedge for much contemporary and future American Catholic participation in social reform, unquote. Asserts, contrary to the evidence, that this interpretation of Rerum Novarum has overemphasized the social view of property. This reflects a bias in the interpreters against individualism and self-interest, unquote. But the bias against individualism and self-interest is the bias of the Roman State Church, as we have demonstrated through many quotations from papal encyclicals. Sirico's conspiracy of left-wing interpreters who have twisted the Pope's finely honed defense of private property and capitalism into an endorsement of interventionism and social reform is a fantasy. It would be difficult to overemphasize the bias of the Roman State Church against private property, self-interest, and capitalism. Furthermore, that bias continues to be expressed by the Roman State Church, even in the very encyclical that Sirico tells us is a ringing endorsement of capitalism. After admitting that the modern business economy has positive aspects, the Pope wrote, many other people, while not completely marginalized, live in situations in which the struggle for a bare minimum is uppermost. These are situations in which the rules of the earliest period of capitalism still flourish in conditions of ruthlessness in no way inferior to the darkest moments of the first phase of industrialization. The human inadequacies of capitalism and the resulting domination of things over people are far from disappearing. Furthermore, continuing with a quote from John Paul II, it is right to speak of a struggle against an economic system if the latter is understood as a method of upholding the absolute predominance of capital, the possession of the means of production and of the land. In the struggle against such a system, what is being proposed as an alternative is not the socialist system, which in fact turns out to be state capitalism, but rather a society of free work. Such a society is not directed against the market, but demands that the market be appropriately controlled by the forces of society and the state. Earlier in the paper that the controlled market, of course, is the definition of fascism. That's what fascism means. Or, it is unacceptable to say that the defeat of so-called real socialism, keep in mind that he wrote this after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the communist countries in Europe, it is acceptable to say that the defeat of so-called real socialism leaves capitalism as the only model of economic organization. If by capitalism is meant a system in which the freedom in the economic sector is not circumscribed within a strong juridical framework which places it at the service of human freedom in its totality, then the reply to the question, is capitalism the model for the third world, is certainly negative. Building on the interventions that are already in place, the Roman State Church wants more. It is the task of the state to provide for the defense and preservation of common goods, such as the natural and human environments, which cannot be regulated simply by market forces. Just as in the time of primitive capitalism, the state had the duty of defending the basic rights of workers, so now with the new capitalism, the state and all of society have the duty of defending those collective goods. Contrary to what Sirico alleges, there seems to be only one sentence in the entire encyclical of about 28,000 words, as closely as I could estimate it, that seems to lend any support to the market economy. It does so only on grounds of efficiency, not morality, and the Pope immediately qualifies it. This is what he says. It would appear that on the level of individual nations and of international relations, the free market is the most efficient instrument for utilizing resources and effectively responding to needs. But this is true only for those needs which are solvent, insofar as they are endowed with purchasing power, and for those resources which are marketable, insofar as they are capable of obtaining a satisfactory price. But there are many human needs which find no place on the market. It is a strict duty of justice and truth not to allow fundamental human needs to remain unsatisfied and not to allow those burdened by such needs to perish. Sirico provides no quotations, nor even any citations, to support his sweeping assertion that the encyclical gives a moral endorsement of profit, self-interest, and a stable currency. This writer has found no such statements in the encyclical either. Therefore, I am forced to conclude that Sirico's assertion of a moral endorsement of capitalism by the Roman State Church in Centesimus Annus is false. Perhaps Sirico is confused by John Paul II's reference to certain character traits as virtues, namely industriousness, diligence, prudence, courage, and reliability. But endorsement of these character traits does not constitute an endorsement of profit, self-interest, and a stable currency, let alone capitalism. John Paul II tentatively, it would appear, praises only the efficiency of the free market, and he does so only because the communist systems of Europe had collapsed 2 years earlier. But even that tentative praise is immediately weakened and qualified, and the paragraph ends by the Pope asserting, on moral grounds, the duty of the state, quote, not to allow fundamental human needs to remain unsatisfied, unquote, as they will in a free market, even a market already regulated by government. This one tentative sentence about the efficiency of the market is buried in the middle of a document that repeatedly condemns real capitalism and repeatedly reaffirms the Roman State Church's commitment to its fundamental principle of the universal destination of goods, the primacy of need, and government control of the economy. One can sympathize with an American Roman Catholic who is embarrassed by the fact that his allegedly infallible church has preached statism and collectivism and has condemned capitalism on moral grounds for more than a century. One can even understand his desperate desire to scrounge any crumb from his infallible church that might seem to favor capitalism and freedom. But neither his desperation nor his embarrassment is an excuse for misrepresenting Centesimus Annus as a moral endorsement of capitalism. Sirico's claim that Centesimus Annus is a repudiation of the entire collectivist agenda, root and branch, has no support in the text itself, and it must be understood as false propaganda promoting the Roman State Church. Sirico writes as a Roman priest, not as a scholar. and finish by going back to an earlier section, the encyclical of Paul VI in 1967 on page 18. The top of the page there, first full paragraph. In the 1960s, Paul VI assailed capitalism whenever he could. His encyclical Populorum Progressio on the Progress of Peoples, issued in 1967, was a sustained assault on capitalism. He wrote, and I quote, "But it is unfortunate that on these new conditions of society, a system that is the new conditions of society that prevailed in the 19th century, a system has been constructed which considers profit as the key motive for economic progress, competition as the supreme law of economics, and private ownership of the means of production as an absolute right that has no limits and carries no corresponding social obligation. This unchecked liberalism leads to dictatorship, rightly denounced by Pius XI as producing, quote, the internal imperialism of money, unquote. One cannot condemn such abuses too strongly. But if it is true that a type of capitalism has been a source of excessive suffering, injustices and fratricidal conflicts whose effects still persist, it would also be wrong to attribute to industrialization itself evils that belong to the woeful system which accompanied it. Paul VI wanted industrialization, but not capitalism. That is also what the Marxists want. He even denounced capitalism as a woeful system and a dictatorship, while rejecting on moral grounds profit-making, competition, and private ownership of the means of production. Commenting on the encyclical, Ayn Rand asked, if concern for human poverty and suffering were one's primary motive, one should seek to discover their cause. One would not fail to ask, why did some nations develop while others did not? Unquote. The Roman state church, of course, could not ask such a question, for her own teachings and hegemony were the cause of economic stagnation, poverty, and suffering. And where those teachings had been abandoned and her hegemony cast off, economies developed rapidly after more than a millennium of economic stagnation. Populorum Progressio was such a strident attack on capitalism that the Wall Street Journal made excuses for it. A similar situation arose in 1996 when John Paul II endorsed the theory of evolution. At that time, newspaper columnist Cal Thomas, among others, excused the Pope because his translators allegedly garbled his words. The journal declared, in effect, that the Pope didn't mean what he seemed to have said. The encyclical, it alleged, was just a misunderstanding caused by some mysterious conspiracy of Vatican translators who misinterpreted the Pope's ideas in transferring them from their original Latin into English. This is a quote from the Wall Street Journal. His Holiness may not be showering compliments on the free market system, but he is not at all saying what the Vatican's English version appeared to make him say. Unfortunately, the Wall Street Journal and all others who try to excuse the infallible Pope by saying he has incompetent translators, the Vatican has had 30 years to correct the allegedly incorrect translation, but the encyclical reads as it did in 1967. Ayn Rand, who understood the ethical and economic differences between capitalism and collectivism, pointed out that the progress of the peoples was endorsed with enthusiasm by the communist press the world over. The French Communist Party newspaper, Humanity, said the encyclical was often moving and constructive for highlighting the evils of capitalism long emphasized by Marxists. Reports the New York Times, March 30th, 1967. I don't have time to go into all the details of this, but if you look through that and read the sections we skipped on the economic thought, you'll see the evidence for the statements I've made there on the front page, where the Roman Church has not only endorsed feudalism and guild socialism, fascism, Nazism, interventionism, and the welfare state, but liberation theology as well. Then you can get some idea of how thoroughly collectivist an institution it is, how inimical it is to a free enterprise or a capitalist system, how thoroughly hostile it is. It attacks every aspect of the capitalist system, beginning with self-interest, individualism, profit, capital, ownership of the means of production. It advocates a regulated, what it calls a regulated market, which is precisely what Mussolini and Hitler advocated. In fascism and communism is this. The Roman Church opposed communism, not in its economic doctrines, but in its metaphysical doctrines. Marx was an atheist, and they opposed the atheism of Marx and his followers. Economic doctrines they could live with. In communism, the government actually takes title to the property formerly owned by private citizens, and it operates that property as assets of the state. In a fascist or a Nazi system, the owners are allowed to keep their property titles. They just do what they're told by the heads of the departments of government. The U.S. is a fascist system. I give a quote from Joe Klein in the paper, saying that the largest block of voters in the U.S. are Roman Catholics. It's the Roman Catholics, he says, who gave us the New Deal. It's the cities of the Northeast who gave us Tammany Hall, who gave us the Daily Machine in Chicago, who gave us the Curly Machine in Boston. It's the Catholic voters who elect the liberal Congresses. Joe Klein is not a Calvinist, to my knowledge. He's a columnist, not a Calvinist. And very rare to have those two things combined. And he recognizes the reality of where these things came from. These voters were acting in response to Rerum Novarum. They were acting in response to the Roman Catholic Congresses at the end of the 19th century saying we've got to have a progressive income tax. So we get the 16th Amendment to the Constitution saying that progressive income taxes are now constitutional. All of this major features of the welfare system were developed as an outcome of Rerum Novarum and advocated by Catholic theoreticians in the U.S. Questions? The owners are allowed to keep their property titles. They just do what they're told by the heads of the departments of government. The U.S. is a fascist system. Adopted since the 1930s, a fascist form of economic organization in the U.S. The government is regulating everything. In Nazi Germany, the great German industrialists were not expropriated by the Hitler regime. They were simply told what to do by the heads of the economic departments of the Hitler regime. They were allowed to keep titles to their property, but the property was controlled by government. Now, this distinction between legal ownership and the use of property is a distinction that the popes themselves developed in their encyclicals. Read my paper thoroughly, you'll see how that thought developed, this distinction between legal ownership and use of property. Hostile to communism because of its atheism. But not favor a collectivist system. They prefer fascism because it appears to keep some of the trappings of private property. Krupp is allowed to keep his factories. But what he does is controlled by the German finance ministry. Or in this case, IBM is allowed to keep its factories, but what IBM does in a thoroughly fascist system is determined by the various cabinet members of the U.S. government. That is one of the reasons why we have a welfare state, a redistributive state, a regulatory state in the U.S. I give a quote from Joe Klein in the paper, saying that the largest block of voters in the U.S. are Roman Catholics. It's the Roman Catholics, he says, who gave us the New Deal. It's the Roman Catholics in the cities of the Northeast who gave us Tammany Hall, who gave us the Daily Machine in Chicago, who gave us the Curly Machine in Boston. It's the Catholic voters who elect the liberal Congresses. Joe Klein is not a Calvinist, to my knowledge. He's a columnist, not a Calvinist. And very rare to have those two things combined. And he recognizes the reality of where these things came from. These voters were acting in response to Rerum Novarum. They were acting in response to the Roman Catholic Congresses at the end of the 19th century saying we've got to have a progressive income tax. So we get the 16th Amendment to the Constitution saying that progressive income taxes are now constitutional. This major features of the welfare system were developed as an outcome of Rerum Novarum and advocated by Catholic theoreticians in the U.S.